Hello, and welcome to Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. Each year, the prestigious Beverly Ault Scholarship provides senior fellows at the Kinghorn Cancer Centre in Sydney an opportunity to enrich their educational and career training activities. This fellowship honours the life of Beverly Ault and the compassionate care she received at the Kinghorn Cancer Centre. As such, our very own Dr. Josh Hurwitz abandoned me to go gallivanting in the United States of America. He was able to attend the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in Texas, as well as engage with some of the brightest minds in cancer care and research at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Meanwhile, I was left to freeze in one of the coldest Australian summers on records. No, I'm not bitter. Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, supported by the Kinghorn Cancer Centre and the Beverly Ault Scholarship, is incredibly honoured to present a series of interviews with specialists who have influenced the course of medical oncology on both a global and personal scale, providing the promise of innovative, personalised medicine. In this episode, Josh interviews the man who helped make this grand adventure possible, his mentor, Professor Elgene Lim of the Kinghorn Cancer Centre in Sydney. Professor Lim is a medical oncologist specialising in breast cancer research. He has previously worked at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, completing his PhD under the mentorship of Dr. Jeffrey Lindman and Dr. Jane Visvada, with research focused on identifying culprit cells in BRCA1 mutant gene carriers. He subsequently worked with Dr. Eric Weiner and Dr. Miles Brown at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Harvard Medical School. As if this was not enough, Elgene is proud of his volunteer work with asylum seekers and his work with the Ashra Kiran Hospital in Orissa, India, in a program of expertise transfer and partnership with local doctors.
Hi, Elgene. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Amazing. So for those that don't know, Elgene has been my mentor for the last 18 months, and I begged him to come onto the show as the final person in our extravaganza from Dana-Farber. And Elgene, you had quite a unique perspective on life, but also what you've done in oncology that sets you apart somewhat from the wider oncological community here in Australia. But I'd love to talk about your early days, your foundation years, as I like to call. So for those that don't know, Elgene grew up in Singapore, and I don't want to give anything else away, but tell me about your early years. What led you to ending up doing medicine and, I guess, finally pursuing this world of oncology?
Yeah, so I think there's the adage that your parents know you best. And when I first started off, I actually wanted to be a bus driver when I was five, and then that progressed on to wanting to being a pilot, a fighter pilot specifically, when I was in my teens, and then and medicine was kind of last on the list. My parents always thought that I would probably make a good doctor. They weren't sure. There's no doctors in my family, but you know, long story short, I ended up doing medicine in the end after a fairly convoluted journey.
And so I'd like to dig a little deeper into that convoluted journey, because I know you've told me before, but I found it quite fascinating. How did it go? Like, how did you switch? Because, you know, when we're all 18, no one really wants to listen to their parents or their advice. But how did you go from being a truck driver, or sorry, a bus driver, to medicine?
Yeah, a lot of it's circumstantial. So my sort of having been brought up in Singapore, there is conscription, and my parents were quite keen to get me out of serving in the army before I finish my university education. So the only way was to come to Australia, get into university before I was 17. And that way, I was too young to be conscripted, that way it forced me to pick a vocation at the end of year 12, at the age of 17, it was a bit of a random potluck. I had a variety of options in there that weren't very consistent throughout, but it just happened that I got into medicine at Melbourne Uni And the deal was, if I finished my university education, then my parents said I could go on and be a pilot if I wanted to, or do whatever I wanted to do.
So you ended up in Melbourne, you know, the most livable city in the world, 7 years straight. I don't know if it still is. What was it like? You know, I think that's something that you've done this a number of times in your life. What's it like moving country, being young? You didn't have Google Maps or the you know, the internet plethora that we have these days. You know, new city, degree, you're young, it's medicine, it's not an easy path. It's not an easy path in a foreign country.
Yeah.
How did that go for you?
So the backstory is, I was actually born in Melbourne, and I reconnected with my godparents who are an Australian family. So at the age of 16, when I moved back, they helped me reintegrate back to life in Australia. And Uncle Bob and Auntie Helen were great in that regard. I think staying with an Australian family really helped me transition back very smoothly. And I just came back for that year 12, did well enough to get into medicine, and then the rest is history. But a lot of it goes to Uncle Bob and Auntie Helen, you know, just really helping me settle in that challenging transition year.
Yeah, still quite an astounding feat in itself. So you finished med school. You know, I'm digging a little bit deeper because I'm part of this story. And you didn't go straight into physician's training, as we call it in Australia. You kind of sort of veered off the career sort of trajectory a little bit. What happened there?
Yeah, so I eventually got conscripted in Singapore. They don't let you off that easily. So after my internship, I went and served for 2.5 years in the Air Force, which kind of leads back to my original goal, which was to be a fighter pilot. But it was a bit too late. I think I was able to get on choppers or helicopters as part of the search and rescue team. I was a captain of a medical platoon, and it was great. So for 2.5 years, got to kind of play soldier and enjoy the aspects of life being a little bit detached from medicine. Even though I was a medical officer in the Army, I got to do a lot of relatively fun things. And I think it was an important detour in my life because it taught me other life skills, which I found very useful that I still use today.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And much to your mother's chagrin, but at least you're doing something medical. Mm. So everyone was a little bit happy. And I know you've told me previously a story of your encounter when you went traveling to India. Mm. And I'd hope you'd tell our audience a little bit how that helped crystallize a little bit of your journey.
So after 2.5 years in the Army, I had 6 months to kill before coming back into the Australian medical training program. So in that 6 months, I thought I'd try to travel the world. And I guess a part of me in terms of why I ended up doing medicine in the first place was this rather naive desire to make an impact or save the world. So in that 6 months, I looked for opportunities to volunteer medically. I volunteered in capacity in India, where it was in a disaster relief situation. So I went to Calcutta and then Orissa back in 1999. And I was fortunate to have met general practitioner Dr. Goh Wei Leong, who took me under his wings, and as a very first trip to India, showed me around and really, you know, I think imparted his humanitarian streak to me.
Okay. I wanted to say that because I think that that's quite important sort of for the rest of your career. So you did physician's training, you kind of got through the hard yards, and then you set your sights of oncology. Was it always oncology during physician's training? Was it you just saw that there was this niche that was going to explode, as we can see today? Most of the FDA drugs seem to be some variety of immunologics first for a cancer patient, but I'd love to know how you kind of fell into that area.
Yeah, oncology has evolved over time. And certainly back then, you know, oncology was just at the beginnings of targeted therapy in terms of, you know, I remember as a AT, Herceptin data was first presented back then, and there was a standing ovation at ASCO when the data was shared with the audience. So it was still early days, but certainly when I got into oncology, the major driving force was really my experiences as an oncology basic trainee. As with most basic trainees, we rotate through different specialties. And there was no specialty that brought as much satisfaction as working in an oncology ward. And in fact, that one patient encounter that really still resonates with me is caring for a young patient with osteosarcoma who died while she was under my care in that term. And I developed a very close bond with her and with her parents. And in fact, after that experience, I vowed not to do oncology because I didn't think that I was suited for it, considering I felt like I crossed the boundary. However, then rotating through all the other specialties, never really found an experience quite that moving or meaningful. And that's what then led me back to do oncology.
It almost seems like that's the mantra of the best oncologists, the ones that feel like maybe they shouldn't do it because they care too much. You finished your training, but you didn't stay in Australia. Mm. A bit of a nomadic life still. Mm. And you sort of set your sights abroad. And I don't want to ruin that, but I'd love to know, first of all, how you had the guts to kind of do what you did and how that shaped the next 10 years of your career.
Sure. I did my PhD actually at the Walter Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne. But, you know, it sounds weird, but it was actually, I was doing what was back then the norm. Most of my mentors, such as Michael Green, Peter Gibbs, they all went overseas. So a generation ago, most oncologists or senior oncologists would actually go overseas and then come back. So in fact, that was the norm back then. And because of their mentorship, I decided very early on in my career, after graduating from oncology and doing my PhD, that was what I was going to pursue. And it was through a chance meeting with Eric Weiner, who was visiting Australia giving a talk, that I went up to him as a oncology trainee and introduced myself to him. And I said, Eric, I would love an opportunity to come and work in Boston. He then told me that he has not had someone from overseas work for him before, but he was very kind and gave me an open invitation to visit him the next time I was in the US, which I promptly did within the next 12 months. And one thing led to another, and I ended up being the first international breast cancer fellow at the Dana-Farber.
Amazing. And how many, I don't know if you know the answer to this, how many fellows have followed your footsteps at Dana-Farber?
It's grown, and through your recent visit to Dana-Farber, you would have met a few of them. So they get a few each year now. There are many donors in the U.S., and this particular donor with the surname Goldfarb has given lots of money to bring many people from all over the world to take part in this fellowship program.
Yeah, most of them are from Italy and Brazil when I went and visited them. So you learned from the best of the best, really. You know, Boston is sort of, to an extent, the mecca of medical oncology for many of us. And then you came home. Mm. You know, you came back, you were in Melbourne and then Sydney, but I'd love to sort of understand. So you did all this extra training. You ended up at St. Vincent's here in Sydney, and you managed to sort of open a lab, which to most of us who do our training, like opening a lab, becoming a clinician scientist and sort of choosing your own adventure is sort of seems very far-fetched. Again, you've got the skill set, I think, approaching Eric Weiner, who was previous ASCO president and quite a large figure in the field of breast cancer oncology. But I'd love to know how you managed to sort of navigate your way and build that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was anything clever or overly intentional on my part. A lot of life is serendipity and just being in the right place at the right time. So when I returned to Australia from Boston, it was at a time where a patient with breast cancer by the name of Connie Johnson was diagnosed with breast cancer, and her brother, who's Samuel Johnson, who's a Golden Logie winner and a very well-known actor, made his name in Secret Life of Us and subsequently other TV shows, including Molly, which he won his Golden Logie for. He took a year off his acting and decided to cycle across Australia on a unicycle and raise a significant amount of money. They very generously, through their organization called Love Your Sister, donated that money to the Garvan. And the Garvan then used that money to do a search for someone to lead a new breast cancer laboratory here at the Garvan. And that, you know, story short, happened to be me. So it then brought me from Melbourne over to Sydney after returning from Boston.
Okay, and you've been here ever since.
I've been here ever since, correct.
And a couple of the things that you've been working on or you've done, and I'd like to, I think, highlight and talk about their significance in the Australian landscape. The first being, you know, the annual Breast Cancer Symposium open to both clinicians and patients. Was this something that you started? Was it a collaborative effort? Was there a space in not so much the market, but a need to kind of bring these sorts of education things to our shores? Tell me, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so this is really a partnership with Professor Alex Swarbrick, who's a very close collaborator of mine here at the Garvan. Alex is a scientist, a discovery scientist, and we kind of work and complement each other on the spectrum of medical and breast cancer research. And Alex and I have a great partnership, and we really felt that this could serve as a bit of a template to bring together our very rather disparate communities of basic researchers and clinicians for a short meeting each year. So pretty much from the first year I arrived, we put together a program sought relevant sponsorship, and this has now been running for 8 years already. But we thought, in addition to bringing together the medical and the research scientific community, we would also like to involve the public through an educational program, because a lot of science that is shared is not easily accessible to the public. So we then extended that research symposium we have by another half a day, focus purely on the public and consumers, and it's about bringing to them some of the highlights in the research world from the last year, and just really presenting it to them and allowing them to come to an understanding of some of the major developments in the field of breast cancer research.
Amazing. And considering how difficult it is for clinicians, let alone, you know, consumers, to understand the complexities of this research, it's such a fundamental need.
Yes.
Not only in oncology, but beyond that. And this kind of adds to something else I want to talk about. You're currently working on a project. It's called the Clinical Trials Connect. I don't know if it's an app or a website.
Yes.
And I've had multiple conversations with clinicians and industry, and they talk about how difficult it is, A, to bring trials to Australia, but B, also to find appropriate trials for patients.
Yes. Know,
we're a public system predominantly, so we share our patients here in Australia. But to get the right trial for the right patient, if it's not open at every site, it's hard. Mm. What is your vision for this program that you're spearheading?
Yeah. So it's actually a website, but also an app called Clinical Trials Connect. It's arisen because the clinical trials landscape in Australia is increasingly complex, particularly in cancer. And that's a good problem to have. It's a reflection of the increasing number of clinical trials that are being brought to Australia, giving patients more options to participate in clinical trials. I do believe that there is a great sense of altruism in our community, that patients do want to participate in clinical trials, not necessarily just for potential benefit to themselves, but really to contribute to moving the science forward to make the world a better place for the next generation of women. So the problem is, as the landscape becomes more crowded with more clinical trials, it becomes increasingly difficult for not just the patients, but also the oncologist to know what trials are available. So this particular website puts together all the relevant trials in breast cancer in Australia, and then runs it through an algorithm whereby patients answer 15 questions. And based on their answers for those 15 questions, we could narrow down the 150 to 200 breast cancer-specific trials that there are in Australia down to about 5 to 10 clinical trials that they're potentially eligible for, so that they don't have to scroll through all 150 trials, breast cancer trials. And it also tells them where these trials are being run, who to contact. And in doing so, we actually accelerate the trial accrual process, trial completion process. And overall, I think we move the field forward a lot faster through that partnership with patients.
Yeah, time toxicity is not only a thing that patients experience, but also clinicians when it comes to identifying appropriate trials and, you know, finding the right collaborators and right individuals to put them on. So it's a great initiative.
Can I just add, I think, you know, the patients have a great drive and desire, strong desire to seek out clinical trials. Mm. And as we know, oncologists are often very, very busy and may not even have the tools to go and identify the right trial for them outside their own institution. Yeah. We have tools within our own institution to help us identify the relevant trials within our network, but beyond that, it becomes a little bit more challenging. So this tool actually empowers the patients with their right motivation to seek out trials and find out information about those trials and where they run, and then without necessarily having to rely on a very busy oncologist to know where these trials are.
And you might not be able to answer this question, but do you know when this website is going live?
Yeah, so we've undergone beta testing. It's actually relatively IT complex, and we've needed people with IT expertise to help us set this up and set up the algorithm. So we've gone through beta testing. We've now... this has been actually a passion project up to now, but we've managed to convince or present this concept to a few pharmaceutical companies who've now given us grants to enable us to then launch it. So we anticipate launching it this year.
Great. Mm. Hopefully no bugs to delay the launch. I might move on a little bit from your passion projects and kind of focus a bit more on that breast cancer and your research. So you do a lot of research with xenografts, something that in training you generally have zero experience with. Mm. What exactly got you into xenografts? And tell me about how you utilize this in your research.
Yeah. So I got first involved in breast cancer xenografts during my PhD. So what this essentially means is taking a tissue from one species and implanting it into another species. So typically, as we're working with breast cancer, we would take the breast cancer from patients and then implant it into a mouse, which is a different species. And we actually specifically implant it into the breast of a mouse or the mammary gland of a mouse. So that way, the way I explain to my patients is that the mouse becomes their avatar. But it becomes an ongoing resource because we can grow the tumor. We can actually do experiments in large cohorts of mice through that one initial donation of tissue from the patient to us to allow us to put it into mice. So I learned that skill through doing a PhD with Jeff Lindemann and Jane Visvader in Melbourne. Continued to use those skill sets while I was in Boston. And it's now become a big part of what my lab does because we've, through our partnership once again with the multiple patients who've donated their tissue to us to enable us to create now what is a very, very large library and diverse library of different breast cancer avatars. We can then choose the appropriate breast cancer model in the mouse and match it with the right drug, and then do the relevant experiments. And these experiments being done in a living animal is thought to be a lot far more powerful than necessarily doing experiments in a petri dish as it's traditionally done.
And what's your current focus?
So a major focus of our lab is on resistance to endocrine therapies. So the vast majority of breast cancer express the hormone receptor estrogen receptor, which feeds off estrogen, and anti-hormonal therapies have been the backbone of the treatment for this very common breast cancer subtype. But as we have used this in large numbers of patients, unfortunately, some patients do develop resistance to this type of therapies, and it's understanding how the cancers evade currently used endocrine therapies, what mechanisms arise in terms of resistance, and then finding ways to overcome these mechanisms of resistance.
The holy grail of oncology.
Yeah. Well, you know, every time we find a new treatment, resistance is inevitable. Mm. I have not come across any treatment where resistance doesn't arise. With the new treatment, however, we do change the natural history of breast cancer. So it's not uncommon these days to see patients with metastatic breast cancer living for even up to a decade or more. Whereas, you know, as I was going through medical school, we were taught that, you know, patients with metastatic cancer have typically, you know, a one-year kind of average survival. And, you know, to stretch it out to 10 years, we really, for many types of breast cancer, making it a chronic disease with the right treatments. However, you know, I think cure is still challenging, but we're certainly making it a chronic disease.
Well, definitely, and I think the leaps and bounds even in the last couple of years have been phenomenal from an oncology treatment and breast cancer specific treatments perspective. You do a lot of mentoring. Jane, I'm going to switch tact a little bit.
Yeah.
And you've taken under your wing a number of PhD candidates, fellows like myself. Was that always part of your plan to kind of mentor? I know you've had some incredible mentors in your past
and
that somewhat influenced you, but what do you see as your role from a mentor-mentee?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never really, you know, specifically gone into this intentionally, but I think all of us have a role to play in mentorship because we've all been, most of us hopefully have been the beneficiaries of good mentors before us, and it's important, therefore, to pass it on. I think there are different styles of mentorship, and I certainly would not consider my style necessarily the best style, but it's that your style is really an extension of your personality. I've tended to be one who much prefers to spend time building relationships and rather than collecting large number of mentees and therefore focusing my efforts on a few people. And it's great to, you know, once again, have the privilege of over time having various fellows and registrars and PhD students come through because you then get the opportunity to see this being a continuous process. I think the important thing is to realize, for me anyway, that the individual before me is someone who was in my position not too long ago to have a sort of understanding of their needs, where they're at in their career, to be genuinely interested in them as a person. I think these sort of relationships cannot be forced. So often when I've been matched as a mentor to someone who I completely don't know, it's very hard to develop that relationship. But having a relationship with my PhD student or my registrar, my fellow, that's very easy because we spend a lot of time together. We have coffees together. We get to know each other, and not just about their careers, but also about their families and their other interests as well. So I think the depth of that relationship is important to me. The number is less important.
I have one final question for you, Eljane. Whenever I finish these interviews, you know, it's always going to be a culmination or a time. It's a timestamp in your life, your career, and everything you've experienced in the past. Not so much what's going to happen in the future, but the final question I like to ask is, if you could go back in time to your younger self, it doesn't matter where it is on that spectrum or that line, what would your advice be? You know, it can be professional, it can be personal, something to do with your oncology world, or just a piece of advice to make your life better or sort of help you on that journey. What would that be?
Yeah, it's advice that was actually given to me by my mentors. So number one is not to rush through things and just really to smell the flowers around you. I was told by Michael Green not to rush back to come back to Australia and just really enjoy my time in the US. And I think that was very, very good advice, just to be able to enjoy the moment and enjoy the now. And the things around you are not just within oncology, but that's happening around your life as well. I mean, I look back at my years in Boston as some of the best years in my life, but a lot of it's because of the things we did outside of work as well. The second thing is something I tell to all my fellows and registrars is to model yourself after a number of people, to take the best attributes that you see in each of your mentors and make it a part of you. And at the end of the day, you'll be a better person. You'll be a combination of all these mentors before you when you take on the different attributes and make it Josh. Yes. So you know, it's the same thing. I think I tell my fellows and trainees that, you know, there's certain things that I do which may work well, but there's certain things that I do that may not work well, and you be the judge of that and take what works well and make it part of you.
Wise words. I'm such a humble guy. Eldrin, thank you for helping finish this mini series of oncologists that Michael and I have been producing. It's been a pleasure spending, for me, the last 18 months with you, and for those that listened, approximately 30 minutes, but I hope whoever's listening got something out of this. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, that's inquisitiveonc.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc or via email at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ADC Productions.